No, so perhaps we can start by talking about what research findings you've actually been implementing.
Mm-hmm. I've been looking at the research for upper limb rehabilitation for children with unilateral cerebral palsy. Unfortunately, we don't have any clinical practice guidelines, but we do have quite considerable body of evidence now. Just in the last 4 or 5 years, I've been updating a systematic review I did in 2009 when there were only 12 randomised controlled trials of upper limb rehab for these children. Now we've got 42. So in that small amount of time, there's been an almost fourfold increase in the body of evidence. A lot of that has been particularly in the area of modified constraint-induced movement therapy, intensive bimanual training, and hybrid models that sequentially apply modified constraint followed by biannual training. So there is a lot of evidence, but unfortunately we don't have clinical practice guidelines at this point. So what we've done is, based on all of that evidence, we've identified 5 evidence-based criteria that we're working towards. And they are, first and foremost, that therapy should be goal-directed, and they're not therapist-derived goals, but really the goals identified by children and their families, and that we should be measuring those goals objectively. Also, we need to be using more contemporary motor learning-based approaches. So, unfortunately, some of the older models of therapy, like neurodevelopmental therapy, are still very commonly used, despite a very big lack of evidence for their efficacy. So using contemporary motor-based learning approaches, the delivery or the model of therapy could be flexible. In all of the publications we've got almost as many models of therapy as there are publications. So there's a lot of flexibility that therapists can adopt in terms of whether to use really intensive, short-duration interventions, whether to use more distributed models augmented with evidence-based home programs. Also, the fourth criteria is that we need to achieve an adequate dose. And this is a really tricky one because we don't know exactly what that adequate dose is, but we do know that it is a lot more than what is standard practice, which tends to be 6 or 8 weekly sessions of OT that might or might not have a home program with them. And then the last criteria was that we should be measuring our upper limb outcomes using an objective and reliable measure.
Okay. So that goes on to the second question: what practice or behaviour are you trying to change, and who are the targets?
The targets are 3 teams. 2 at the Royal Children's Hospital in Brisbane within the Department of Rehabilitation. One is the Queensland Paediatric Rehab Service, and the other is the Queensland Cerebral Palsy Health Service. And the third team is a regional paediatric team from Cairns.
So it's a mixture of disciplines?
It's predominantly OT. In fact, it's all OT.
Okay, and therapy assistants as well? Or?
Therapy assistants will be potentially involved in the delivery of the interventions. In terms of trying to achieve an adequate dose, we've really problem solved around that and come up with 2 potential options, and that is, one, to have a block model or a shorter intense model but augmented with a home program, so hopefully things are practiced at home in context. And the other option is to move away from some individual based therapy and look at group based interventions and pool what the time that would be used for an individual child together with other children, so you have a bigger, amount of time to play with. So they're the 2 options. So for the second option with group-based interventions, that's certainly where we're looking at involving allied health assistants to help with the setup and the running of those groups.
So just the first part of that question, what sort of practice or behaviour are you trying to change in those teams? Is that the 4 points you made at the beginning, the goal set with the client?
Yes, that measured objectively, achieving an adequate dose, whatever adequate would be, but we're saying it's more than what is current standard practice, and that there would be some measurement of upper limb outcome at the end of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, on to the third question. How do you know that there's an evidence gap there at the moment in practice with those teams?
With those teams, done a file audit, And that's the baseline at the beginning of the implementation program. So, and the results are completely different for every single team. There's nothing really consistent across any of the teams, even for the two teams that are within the same department in the hospital. The results are quite different. One of the things that they were doing generally quite well is that they were setting goals with clients, not all the time, but a reasonable amount of time, but then they weren't measuring them very consistently, either pre or post.
To look at goal achievement.
To look at goal achievement. And it was really interesting doing the file audits, and the therapists go, why are we setting goals and we're not measuring it? They couldn't believe that that was something that had happened. And again, it was when you're caught up in those busy clinical roles, it's really easy to let those things slide, I think. So that was one of the things around the goal setting. In terms of using contemporary motor learning-based approaches, very few had used constraint or modified constraint-induced movement therapy. In fact, only a handful of therapists had tried it and generally found it not terribly successful for a number of reasons. Also, in terms of that flexibility I talked about, the only way therapy was delivered was via individual therapy, so no group-based interventions. And sometimes there was a record of a home program being given, sometimes not, but no record of actually how much home program had been done. So when we came to look at how much therapy children were actually receiving, we couldn't gauge that because the documentation wasn't there. And in terms of assessing upper limb outcomes, they were done so infrequently. And again, that was the reflection from therapists, was that they're in really busy clinical caseloads and it's very hard to find the time to do the assessment, and if they do the assessment, then it's really hard to find the time to actually score the assessments.
And interesting that you say there was a difference across the teams. That's consistently what you seem to see in a lot of these projects. You can't generalise that everybody will have the same baseline performance or the same barriers. So the next one is, what strategies or intervention are you using to help change the practice with those teams?
The first was audit and feedback. And interestingly, anecdotally from the therapists, they weren't so sure on the process at the beginning, but when they had gone through it, they said that was very valuable because they hadn't realised what they were doing and what they weren't doing. So that was a very useful. And also it gave them then, we sat down afterwards, and they set themselves goals based on what the results of the audit had been. So they set themselves goals and an action plan of what they were going to do to change what in their practice towards these evidence-based criteria. The other thing that came up, and this is, I think, your next question about the barriers, but some of the issues around knowledge and training. So we did some interactive training workshops. So they revolved around, there were some consistent areas in terms of knowledge and skills that came up across all the different teams. Quite a few of the therapists had been away on maternity leave and said, we've been away, we've just lost touch of where things are at, we just want an overview of where the evidence is. So that was one of the first things that was said fairly consistently across all the teams. The other thing revolved around home programs and the idea that, and the perception, the belief that perhaps they weren't as effective as what they could be. And some of the therapists felt that they were asking or imposing on families rather than having it as a collaborative kind of process of developing things that mattered to the family and trying to embed it at home. So there were a lot of things around home programming. And also in terms of clinical decision-making processes, what are the characteristics of a child that you might... that might lead you to think that modified constraint protocol might be a good way to start, or no, perhaps with this particular child, a bimanual training approach might be a better way to go. So we did lots of like videos and joint problem solving based on a decision tree that I developed.
For selecting people.
Yes, and the kinds of considerations that you need to make in determining what sort of mode of intervention you might.
I guess it's education as the intervention.
Education and a lot of that was very much practical videos, identifying you know, from videos, working out what would be the goals for these children, and
I guess how to do how to do constraint therapy in a modified way.
That's right. So there was audit and feedback and very interactive education training were the two strategies.
And with the feedback about the audits, did you do all the audits, or did some of the therapists do audits
No,
as well?
No, we all did them, and that was the requirement that we set up at the beginning. And I think I felt it would be better or more beneficial if they could actually see, you know, it wasn't just me
what
telling them, but that they were actually part of that process identifying where
It really is an intervention on its own, isn't it?
It is an intervention
on its own.
The feedback
and particularly the audit, if they do the audit.
Yes, and I think then it was, we did organise a very large meeting afterwards, and I think it took nearly 2 hours, but they sat down after I pulled all the results together and I presented the results, and they got to sit and think about it and work out, well, what did they want to change and how were they going to make sure that it could happen? And then I didn't have to do anything. I just sat back and they just... Mm. went on and did it all themselves because they were so motivated. Mm. So
the next one is about barriers that typically are different for different teams. How did you go about identifying them? And you've mentioned knowledge already.
Yes.
Anything else?
I did individual interviews and focus groups with all the involved therapists. So knowledge and certainly skills, one of them, but depending on which team, there were different issues. So for the cerebral palsy health team, it was very much within a medical model. One of the difficulties in terms of doing upper limb assessments for the OTs was that they were required to be in clinic and they might only have gotten 5 minutes with the child within this very kind of structured medical model. Mm. So that was good for them to articulate, and we problem solved that, and they've managed to go through their management group and could set up an OT assessment clinic.
Mm.
And so that's how they're managing to get their assessments done. And it's actually working quite nicely because they can get them done before the clinics, and then they're feeding really good information to the doctors who are then deciding about upper limb Botox and all those kind of things. So it's worked out really nicely, I think.
Mm. Mm.
The other issues in terms of... So that was particular for that team. For the paediatric rehab team, this client group is a very small proportion of all the children they see. They see a huge number of children with acquired brain injuries, acquired later in childhood, spinal cord injuries and a whole raft of other complex sort of orthopaedic and other rehab needs. So their issues were trying to balance the competing demands of all those different groups of children coming through rehab and how they could...
Mm.
You know, it was really around dose for them, how they could increase dose without compromising other areas in their clinical service. Then in Cairns, there are so many environmental issues and climate-related issues about families not being able to get to therapy or wanting to get to therapy, particularly in wet season and things perhaps not being as accessible as they could be, and, you know, rain and all those kinds of things you can't really control.
Mm.
And the therapist really talked about, you know, attitudes of families and how hard it was to engage families in therapy in that particular area. And they commented that they felt it was different to Brisbane for whatever reason. So lots of different things came up.
Mm. And any other factors that were enablers to getting change happening? That
probably the biggest thing... the attitudes of the therapists themselves. They're a highly motivated group, incredibly dedicated clinicians who really believed that if they changed their practice for this group of children, that it would lead to better patient outcomes. That was their very, very strong belief. And so they're very motivated by that. I think the other thing is highly supportive management in the various units, incredibly supportive. And they're probably the main things, the people things that...
So nothing environmental that you can think about the places that people worked in or the systems that they worked in?
For the people in CP Health, when I said the clinic and how that was was a barrier, but it was also an enabler as well.
For triggering.
Yes. So while things could be both an enabler and a barrier, at the same time.
If they worked or didn't work.
Yes. Mm. What else? I think the issues around the hospital for families, there are always things, and I think every single therapist said it's really hard to ask families to come in too often because it costs so much to park in the area and the traffic's really bad and all those kinds of issues around considering family sort of needs and the impost on families if, you know, they went to, you know, start doing intensive group-based sort of interventions and what that would mean for families and with other siblings and all that sort of thing. So a lot of things that weren't necessarily easy or to control. The other thing for them was the lack of space at the hospital for running groups and the lack of access a sizable amount of that space. So we really problem-solved around that as well and realised that the hospital school was closed down with this enormous space all during the school holidays and that we could potentially use that. So there's a huge amount of problem-solving around a lot of the different barriers that came up.
To make it happen.
And
how did you go about measuring, or are you going to measure change?
There's a file audit again due towards the end of this year. So really, this is only halfway through, and they're at the point now where they're starting to provide the evidence-based upper limb rehab for the children. So there'll be a file audit later on.
So the actual measure will be what?
It's looking at, again, the file audit is based around those five criteria. So it's looking at how many of the children who are coming through that service who meet this population criteria. How many of them have goals set?
So it's like the proportion of files, the proportion of children that get certain things happening.
The percentage of children who have this. And also we're looking at recording also, with the COPM, because they're mainly using the COPM for the measuring.
The Canadian Occupational Performance Measure.
Yes. So we're looking at also measuring how many of the goals that were set actually changed more than 2 points, which is believed to be clinically meaningful. How many were fully achieved? Did they get to the end of the scale? So we're really trying to look at the differences pre and post, particularly around that measure, because that's the one that was used the most.
So you're looking at the therapist behaviour change and the proportion of their clients that get goal set and dosage changes and so forth.
That's
and then
right.
You're looking at the individual children and their individual outcomes and
that's
then collecting
right.
that together.
That's right. So it'll be COPM outcomes. And predominantly for the therapists at the Royal Children's, it will probably be the assisting hand assessment as the upper limb outcome. It's a bit different in Cairns. They don't have access and nor have any of them had this training and certification in that. So we're looking at other options for them in terms of an upper limb outcome.
And how many files will you have before and after?
We've had about 30 across the three teams.
So about 10 files per team?
Less in Cairns because they've got a much smaller population. I think there might have been 7, and that was inclusive of all of the children in that particular area. And whilst that seems small, it is representative of the population.
And it takes a while to audit files, doesn't it?
Yeah, although everyone was very motivated. I think when they started seeing how different what they were doing, how their behaviour was compared to what they wanted it to be. And I think there were quite a few people who said they were really shocked at the results.
But it creates an urgency.
Shocked but not surprised was, I think, some of the...
Yeah, it does. They talk about it creating an urgency when people see what they're doing and they really want to make a difference. So it does have that effect. Anything else you'd like to add?
I don't think so. I've learnt lots of things along the way, little lessons. Don't assume anything. Don't assume things will be the same. The barriers and enablers will be the same across different teams. Even in the same hospital, they're different. Factor in 4 times as much time as what you think it's going to take, because it takes far, far longer to do anything than what you anticipate. And consult and talk widely, and talk widely beyond the immediate group of people you're working with. Sort of the lessons I've learnt, I suppose.
Okay, thank you very much.